All right, welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. I look at this. I recorded another episode like soon after my previous episode, which I like never do. Okay, so what do I want to talk about today? Let me think here. Should we just do like a grab bag of questions? Like, why don't I just go? There's a bunch of Q&A questions that I can never get to on TikTok and Instagram. Let's just go through them. Just answer questions. Let's just do random stuff today. Sound good. Let's do it. Okay, first up is a random question saying, I've noticed more and more that the primary care doctors are DO rather than MD. What is your opinion about that? So the difference between MD and DO. So yeah, if you go to your doctor, whoever, you know, your primary care or your OB-GYN, whatever, and you see on their little name badge, it says DO and it doesn't say MD. So doctor, DO is doctor of osteopathy, MD is medical doctor. So in that setting, you go to a doctor and their name badge says DO. It does not matter. There is functionally no difference. That is a fact. Because if you're going to a medical institution that has hired someone to be a primary care physician or a family care doc or an OB-GYN or a pediatrician or a critical care physician, and it says DO. If you've hired them, that means they're board certified and they've done a residency and they've trained to become that. A specialist in that, because DOs go through the exact same, if they are board certified, they go through the exact same residency training that MDs go through, identical. And the reason I say, like, when I went to residency, there were several DOs in my residency program. Where I work, there are many DOs that have gone through it. It is the exact same thing. It is not a lesser quality of doctor. It is, I can't stress it enough. It is identical. Now, if someone, let's say someone walks into a cosmetic beauty supply store or whatever, and they do Botox injections or something like that, and it's administered by, and they have an MD or they have a DO. Say they have a DO that works there. Well, in that setting, you're going to want to find out, is that person board certified in anything? Because it's possible that they just went to medical school and they didn't do a residency. And so if you do medical school, if you go to medical school, you just receive a doctor, you know, a doctorate or whatever. You have your medical degree. Or if you go to DO school, you receive a doctor of osteopathy. So you have that license, that certification. And you can take that license and you can like be a consultant for a company or something like that. You can be the face of that company. But you are not specialized in anything because you have not done a residency and you're not board certified. So what I'm saying is you should be skeptical of an MD or a DO if you're in a setting like that. You should look up that person's credentials and see if they're board certified. If they're not, in my opinion, let me just get very real. If someone goes to, you don't learn how to be a doctor from medical school or from DO, whether it's DO or MD. Now the schools are different. What you learn is a little slightly different. Like a doctor of osteopathy, they learn osteopathy, which honestly I really have no idea about. And I do see some DOs being like, oh, you can practice osteopathy. No, they don't. I've never seen a DO practice osteopathy in like a medical setting. That's not a thing. Maybe they do it in their, maybe a primary care physician can do it in their clinic. I have no idea, but I feel like that's a little exaggerated when DOs be like, oh yeah, well I went to DO school because I can practice osteopathy as well. Like I've literally never seen osteopathy being practiced. I hardly even know what it is. What's my point? Someone needs to be board certified to actually practice medicine because that is where you learn your specialty. That's where you learn how to be a doctor, not medical school. Medical school is like, you're just barely like getting your feet on the ground and you're barely learning anything. You do not learn how to be a doctor in medical school because you don't bear the responsibility and you don't learn. It's just a broad thing that you're learning about. You're learning a bunch of broad stuff about a bunch of broad topics, right? It's residency and getting board certified where you actually become a specialist. So I think that answers the question. If you go to see your doctor and they're a DO, it does not matter. They are identical to an MD because medical school training means nothing. It's residency, and then it's the experience that person has, and it's the institution that they work. That's what makes them a good physician. DO, MD, doesn't matter at all. And to go even further than that, you know, talking about NPs and PAs, right? NP is a nurse practitioner. PAs are physician assistants, right? We call these advanced practitioners, APPs, NPPAs. There's lots of terms. Sometimes they're referred to as mid-levels, which is insulting to them. I I do not use the term mid-level because it has become a derogatory term. NPs and PAs are phenomenal people to work with. They're absolutely vital. We must have them. I see so many doctors complain of scope creep that NP PAs CRNAs or nurse anesthetists, which I work with every single day, that they are creeping into the scope of physician. All of this is just a bunch of fear mongering. It's all a bunch of credentialism trying to monopolize the industry, and it's nonsense. Okay, it's nonsense. Anesthesiologists complaining about how they can't sit a case on their own. It is a ridiculous model for an anesthesiologist, for one operating room, to have one anesthesiologist in it. Every single, so if you go into a hospital's operating rooms, every single one of those ORs has one anesthesiologist in it. That is extremely expensive for that patient. And it's not necessary. Having nurse anesthetists care where an anesthesiologist supervises multiple rooms is, number one, extremely safe. And also, it's more cost effective. Those practices like that exist still, right? Where it's just MD, we call it MD only, where it's just an anesthesiologist. You have one anesthesiologist per room who's sitting in the case and not covering a bunch of cases. It's just, from an economic standpoint, they're basically just extracting as much money as possible from the insurance agency, in my opinion. It's not necessary. It's not necessary. But what's my point? Here's one of my points. I go see my primary care. My primary care is an NP. He's an awesome guy. I really appreciate him. I don't demand oh, I must see an MD or a DO. I don't care. Okay. I don't care. This whole thing, scope creep and stuff like that, I reject it. Everybody is needed. We're all a team together. Honestly, let's cut the crap. Everybody, this is all about the bottom line and people keeping a monopoly in the industry and trying to make as much money as possible. Doctors will be like, it's about patient safety, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, maybe it's a little about patient safety as well. Obviously, you need qualified people to be taking care of patients, but that's a whole nother issue. Anyway, let's move on to something else. All right, I got another question by someone who says they say they're a medical student, and they're asking, why would you need ECMO if you're able to walk and talk and you're able to get around? This is a really good question, right? So ECMO, I know, I talk about ECMO a lot because it's what I do. It's a huge part of my practice. So for those that aren't familiar, ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and it's a heart-lung bypass machine that sits outside the patient's body, and we put in these huge tubes in the body. We drain blood continuously from the patient. We oxygenate it. We pump it back into the body. It replaces the function of the lungs. It replaces the function of the heart when those two things are failing, or when just one of those things are failing. So you see these viral videos. I put up many that show a patient who has these huge tubes of blood like coming out of their neck, and they're playing basketball, or they're walking around a unit, or they're dancing, or listening to music, and I celebrate these videos. They're awesome, right? I love finding these videos of patients who are willing to share their experience with the world, which is amazing that they do that. And I've done TikTok lives with people that have been on ECMO from COVID to just celebrate everything that they've gone through. It's just amazing stuff. So it's like, okay, well, why do they need ECMO? You know, if they're doing these things. So these people are in organ failure, and what these videos are showcasing is what ECMO is capable of doing. So these people are walking around. Let's take, you know, someone with COVID, ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, where their lungs are destroyed by the virus, right? The COVID destroys, it literally destroys these people's lungs, destroys them beyond repair. And, for many different processes, it's likely a hyperinflammatory response. The lungs are destroyed and they're not even oxygenating anymore. Their lungs have become basically concrete. They have the compliance now of a propane tank, right? Compliance is how something will comply when you apply pressure to it. So a balloon has really nice, good compliance, right? Put a little air into it. A propane tank does not comply when you pressurize it. It does not move. It does not deform. It stays the same shape regardless. So people that the lungs get destroyed by COVID in this example, they have no compliance of their lungs. And you put them on ECMO and blood is continuously draining from their body. And then we pass it through an oxygenator and then we return it back. And so it is oxygenating their body for them. And so they're able to walk around, particularly if they're young and they're mobile to begin with, they're able to resume their activities, and they should, if you can get people to be up and about, and you can get them up and around. You should do that. The reason you should do that is they should not decondition and waste away and have muscle wasting sitting in a bed. Why? Because then they're not a good candidate for an organ transplant. That is one of the criteria for receiving like an organ, like a heart or a lung, is you need to show that you're not deconditioned, that you're able to walk around, you're able to get around. So that is why it's not just a thing to show off and be cool about. This is good practice to get people out of bed on ECMO. And all the time when I put videos like this up, it's a little disheartening. People would be like, wow, my institution doesn't do this. Wow. And these are like healthcare professionals are saying, wow, I didn't know you could get people up walking around. Like, that is tragic, because your institution should be doing this, in my opinion. This shouldn't be an oddity. This shouldn't be a speculation, just like, whoa, I can't. Everybody should be doing this. That people on ECMO, if you can, should be woken up, and they should get out of bed with physical therapy and occupational therapy and bedside nurse and the physicians and whoever else is there to help out, so that they stay strong. Because just because you're on one of these machines, the rest of your body can start breaking down. Like, you can go to kidney failure, you can go to muscle atrophy, you can develop critical illness, polyneuropathies that cause weakness and deconditioning, and if you start getting those things, then the patient might die anyway because they're deconditioned. ICU deconditioning is a huge problem. So they can still get around because the heart lung machine is doing the thing for them, whatever it is. Whether their heart's not working well, or their lungs not really, it's usually lung failure that you're getting people out of bed. People with heart failure, sometimes you can't get them out of bed because ECMO, yeah, it works, but it has its limitations, and it may not. Sometimes it's only enough just to keep someone alive, just laying in bed. Because patients' bodies have, a certain metabolic demand. And putting someone in ECMO, there's lots of things that come with it, right? And I can talk about ECMO forever. But anyway, that's kind of whatever answer for that. All right, next question is asking me to talk about the extreme cases of people waking up mid-surgery. How does that happen? What does that look like? So this is a very good topic and is an endless topic of confusion. The confusion will never be over about what awareness under anesthesia actually is. So awareness under anesthesia, like accidental awareness under anesthesia, is a true thing. It can happen. It is extremely rare. What is hard to tease apart when someone says, I woke up during procedure. You hear that all the time. The reason why there's so much confusion is what is awareness under anesthesia? And as I'm talking about this, I don't want to invalidate people's experience. A patient's experience matters. And definitions also matter about what is true awareness under anesthesia. So accidental awareness under general anesthesia is when someone has intraoperative consciousness and they later explicitly recall intraoperative events when they should have been unconscious. It's often reported by patients when they have awareness, when it's a part of the anesthetic plan that they may have awareness. I'm being confusing. So true anesthetic. So anesthesia awareness is like someone should be completely under, which is what we call, like a general anesthesia. Maybe they likely have a breathing tube and they're having very invasive, painful surgery. And then they have consciousness during that. That is true awareness under anesthesia, accidental awareness under anesthesia. There are a host of procedures that are done under different types of anesthesia where sometimes it's just minimal sedation. So like someone getting their knee replaced, they can have a spinal, which completely numbs them, and then they're just put on some minimal sedation. And oftentimes people will be like, oh, I remember I woke up during surgery, and then that's what they're referring to. And waking up during that surgery is actually, that's totally acceptable, and that is not true accidental awareness under surgery. That would be expected awareness under anesthesia, unsurprising awareness under anesthesia. And the problem with that, why a patient would think that that's true awareness, is they weren't properly informed about what kind of anesthetic they were going to get. So someone who's getting that type of anesthesia, which we sometimes call MAC, called moderate anesthesia care, or conscious sedation, or twilight anesthesia, they should be told. They should be told, hey, we're going to do this kind of anesthesia. It's not a general anesthesia. You may have recall events or conversations, or you might have some awareness during the procedure. But we will make sure that you are comfortable and safe. That's usually the wording that I use.
Our priority is that you are comfortable and safe. Just because you have some awareness does not mean you will be pain and suffering. Okay, so that's why it's so hard to tease apart. When someone tells me I had awareness under anesthesia, when I have a patient, I ask these questions and kind of get to the root of it. But having said all that, true awareness under anesthesia can happen. The reason it can happen is because human error can happen. And there are certain risk factors for awareness under true anesthesia. And one of them is OB anesthesia. The reason is, so anything that you have to do emergently, you're at risk of having awareness under anesthesia. So having a crash C-section because the baby or the mother's not doing well, and you have to quickly deliver the baby through a C-section, that is a high awareness under anesthesia. And I'm not just talking about having a C-section, a spinal with a C-section, right? The goal with a routine C-section delivery is to have the mother awake with a spinal and no narcotics on board. So the mother is totally awake to be with her child, and so that the child has no narcotics in their system when they're delivered. But a crash C-section, sometimes you have to intubate and go under general anesthesia without any time to even put in a spinal. And so that's why it's high risk. That maybe the surgeon, the OB, started cutting before the patient was totally under. Or maybe it was too light. Maybe the anesthetic got very light on purpose because the patient's blood pressure was crashing. Maybe they were bleeding out, and so we have to lighten our anesthetic. Because why? Our anesthesia drops your blood pressure. Many anesthetics drop your blood pressure, like volatile anesthetics or propofol. So another setting like that is trauma anesthesia. So someone comes in the emergency department, penetrating injuries or bullet injuries to their gut or whatever, their heart, whatever, and they have to emergently go to the operating room. Sometimes they get very, very minimal anesthetic because otherwise they're going to die and we can't give them that much. Sometimes we can only give you a benzo to try to make you not remember, and you can have awareness of anesthesia. So there's risk factors for having awareness under anesthesia. Now, aside from those risk factors, human error can happen. So another risk factor is a type of anesthetic we call TEVA, which stands for total intravenous anesthesia. That means rather than giving you an anesthetic gas through a breathing tube, we give you pure anesthesia through an IV. Now, an IV can infiltrate, and that could cause the cessation of the anesthetic that's being given. But also, this is just too big of a topic. Volatile anesthetic, like a gas, we actually measure how much gas you breathe back out at us, and that is a surrogate for how unconscious you are. So when you have a gas anesthetic, it's more durable that we know you're sedated. But if you're having a TEVA, it may not be as durable. Oftentimes we can put a BIS monitor, which is a type of EEG monitoring, which helps us looks how slow your brain waves are, which can correlate with unconsciousness. But it gets a little messy and hand wavy. But anyway, TEVA might be a risk factor for acute awareness under anesthesia. But the point is, it is very rare. It's extremely rare. I've never had a patient in my career experience that I've heard from that said, hey, I had awareness, true awareness of anesthesia. But it is something, it is an inherent risk of anesthesia, but it is extremely, extremely rare. And for those that it happens to, it's a huge risk factor for PTSD and depression and feeling that, you know, violation of your body, all these terrible things. I wish I could say the risk was 0%, but it's not, because humans are involved in this. As much as we try to outsource a lot of our stuff in anesthesia to machines, humans are still involved, and humans can make mistakes. We can make cognitive errors, and that's why it can happen, unfortunately. All right, next question is, have you ever seen a tracheotomate fistula? This is a great question, and I'll explain what this is. So a tracheotomate fistula is when someone has a tracheostomy tube, which is if someone comes along, puts a hole in your neck, and puts a breathing tube through it. That's called a tracheostomy. For whatever reason, there's many reasons someone has a tracheostomy. Now, and then, so you have a breathing tube, a tracheostomy in your trachea. A tracheotomate fistula is where, so the innominate artery runs across, in normal human anatomy, it runs across the tracheal, the cartilage rings of the trachea, around like through cartilage rings 6 through 9. Now, if you have a tracheostomy with a balloon that's inflated, and it's inflated at too high pressures for a long time, you can have breakdown of your trachea. Your blood supply goes down, and you can start having necrosis of your trachea, and that can create that weakness in the tissues, can create a communication, which is what a fistula is, between the trachea and an artery. That is what it is. That's why it's called a tracheotomate fistula. It's a fistula between the trachea and the innominate artery. Sounds bad, right? You don't want an artery a high-pressure artery that's coming off your heart, hemorrhaging blood into your lungs. That's what this is. It's extremely dangerous when it happens. The mortality is very, very high. You basically have to go, once it's recognized, you have to go on a emergent cardiopulmonary bypass, crash to the operating room, have a cardiothoracic surgeon open your chest to fix it. The chances of someone surviving that on their way down is low. That, you know, they're probably going to hemorrhage out and die or suffocate on the blood in their lungs. So it's a huge deal. I've never seen one personally. But I'm acutely aware of them. And one thing that the one thing you do to mitigate this so it doesn't happen is you make sure the pressure in your trachea balloon is not overpressurized. If you have too much air in there, many things in the human body that cause damage are, it has to do with pressure gradients. So the gradient in the vascular bed, like the capillary bed. Well, let me back it up. Sorry, I'm being too intellectual here. The trachea has a blood supply, and it's supplying blood to the tissues, so it's nice and healthy. If you put too much back pressure from a balloon, and if it's usually greater than 25 centimeters of water, 25, 30, 35, it's greater than that, then you drop your blood supply. And then that's when you start having breakdown of the tissues. And that can happen. So you need to keep your tracheostomy balloons lower pressures, and you need to check the pressures with a manometer. This is a tool. You can hook it up to the pilot balloon of the trachea and look at the pressure. If that is 40, 50, 60, these are commonly overinflated. So if someone has an overinflated balloon with pressures of 50, 60, 70, and you have that applied for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, now you're going to have breakdown tissues. Now you're a high risk for tracheotomy fistula, and which is extremely high risk of death. So that's what that is. That's tracheotomy fistula. It's very dangerous. That's how you prevent it. That's what it's called. And no, I've never seen one, fortunately, and I hope to never see one. All right, another question. Can you explain the difference between RSI intubation and normal intubation? So RSI is called rapid sequence intubation. So rather than normal intubation. So it's very straightforward. The reason we obsessed about people not eating before surgery or having an anesthetic is we don't want your stomach full of food, obviously, because that food can come up through the esophagus. When we relax your body with a bunch of sedatives and paralytic medications, it can relax this natural tension in your esophagus, and then food can come up and go into your lungs, and that can kill you. The worst is that could kill you right away, obviously, but even just having a little bit of acidic fluid in your lungs can cause pneumonitis. It can cause inflammation in your lungs, and that can be very bad as well. It can be not so bad, but it can also cause worse things like ARDS and bad things. So we do not want lung aspiration to happen. That's a preventable thing. Most of the time, it's not 100% preventable, but it's high, very, very preventable. So that's why we don't want you to eat before surgery. Great. So you don't eat. That's fine. Electively, you know, you're having surgery at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Okay, great. I won't eat. Easy, right? But what if you get in a car accident after you had a Denny's Grand Slam breakfast 20 minutes ago and you need to come in, and now you need to be intubated because you need to have emergent surgery? That's when you do rapid sequence intubation, RSI. And the hallmarks of it are rapid sequence, meaning we give our medications in rapid sequence. So what does that tell you? Normally we don't do rapid sequence. So normally we give a sedative. We make sure the patient's asleep before we intubate you. Give a sedative, make sure you sleep, and then we bag mask you, meaning we put a mask over your mouth and nose, and we push on a bag, and we inflate your lungs to be like, okay, we can ventilate this patient. And then we give you a paralyzing medication, and then we put in a breathing tube. You don't, with rapid sequence, you don't RSI, you don't bag mask, because bagging, you're putting in positive pressure into the lungs. Some of that can go into the esophagus down in the stomach, and if you fill the stomach up with fluid, with air, you can then make whatever gastric contents that are come up as well. So rapid sequence intubation is you just give your medications all at once, 1, 2, 3. You don't wait. The patient is awake 1 minute, and then like 30 seconds later, they're completely asleep and paralyzed, and then you do not bag mask, and you immediately put in the breathing tube. That's it. That's all it is. That's rapid sequence intubation. You use it all the time. Oh, and then the question I always get is, do you do cricothyroid pressure, which is, during rapid sequence, and if you're worried about someone having full stomach, there's this kind of old school procedure where you press on their trachea, the cricoid cartilage, and you press it down to cinch off the esophagus, which is just behind the trachea. And that you should do that. Now, there's a huge controversial maneuver. I don't do it anymore. The data is still like way, it's still controversial, but there's people saying there's a lot of data that says if you do it, you actually can dislodge the esophagus laterally and maybe your aspiration risk goes up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to apply the certain amount of pressure. It's like 20 Newtons, as if anybody knows what 20 Newtons are. Anyway, my point is, my practice, I don't do it because what I do is I make sure someone is just sitting up a little. I have, when I intubate them, I put their back up a little bit more to prevent passive regurgitation. And I do not do crack with thyroid because it may work if it's done properly, but not everybody knows how to properly do it. And I don't know if everybody knows how to properly do it. And I don't want to make things worse, so I don't do it. And I think that is a medically, legally defensive. You can defend that. Like, people are like, oh, it's a medical legal thing. Nah. If someone aspirates and you didn't do crack with thyroid, you're not liable for injury because it's totally defensible to not do it as much as it is to do it as well. Anyway. All right, another question. If you smoke marijuana, should you tell your anesthesia provider beforehand that you do? Yeah, you should. And I think I've talked about this before. Just, you know, any illicit drugs that you do, you should tell your... Now, I don't know if you need to be open about that with every single healthcare provider you come across, but probably your anesthesia provider or nurse anesthetist or the anesthesiologist, because it's good for us to know that, because you may need a little bit more medication to get you under, particularly if you habitually smoke marijuana or if you drink daily and you drink heavily daily, you need more anesthesia. Now, we're going to figure that out anyway on our own because we titrate to effect, meaning we give you much... As we're sitting off to sleep, we give you the right amount of medication. Before we paralyze your body, we make sure you're asleep. How do we do that? We like shake you and be like, hello. No, that's not what we do. But we give you sedation and usually we say something like, are you warm enough? So that if you're still awake a little bit, you don't freak out. That we're like, are you asleep? And if the person is out cold, and then we also do this lid reflex where we brush your eyelashes very gently with our finger. And if your lid does not flap up and down, that means you're sedated enough and you're ready for paralytic. Now, I can give you a whole stick of propofol, and if you're still wide awake, that's unusual, and that person is probably doing some sort of recreational illicit drug. And that's fine, whatever. Then I would just give you more until you're asleep. So even if I didn't know that, it's not a big deal, but it's good for us to know. And it's also good for us to know, like, do I need to give you more pain medication? Do I need to give you ketamine? Are you on opiate? Do you take opiates at home? Do you take heroin routinely? Like, these are good things to know for your own health. Now I understand not wanting to tell healthcare providers these things because there's ongoing, you know, stigmatization for drug use and recreational drug use and addiction, substance use disorder, all that stuff, right? And you don't want to have your healthcare workers think less of you or treat you worse or blah, blah, blah. And now I wish I could say, hey, we live in a perfect world. No one's going to judge you, but no, you might have someone judging you for that. And hey, is it going to impact your care? Probably not, but it could. Your pain may not be believed. If someone, particularly a non-anesthesia provider, they may not believe that you're in pain or they may undertreat your pain. So I get all that. I do get that stigmatization. But I would say at least your anesthesia provider, you should be honest about whatever illicit drugs you use. And you should be also honest about your alcohol use. And it's for your own benefit. Anesthesia providers, I think, particularly, we don't care. We don't care what you're doing. Honestly, we don't care. It's not a moral thing. I don't care what you're doing in your free time. I just want to know about it so I can provide the best care for you. All right, one more question here I found. Why is it in the 21st century we just manage symptoms and don't cure things? I think it's a good question. And it's a hard question to talk about without fully understanding the body of all medical literature because, man, so cures... It's weird. This is weird, like, fairy tale narrative of medicine, like, oh, you know, race for the cure of cancer, let's cure this, let's cure that. And it's like curing some diseases cannot be cured currently. With, you know, known medical technology, there are many things that cannot be cured. Symptom management is also an important thing because quality of life matters, so treating symptoms is important. It's not a zero-sum game. We can both treat symptoms of disease and try to find cures of disease. Now, I'm not a researcher. I don't do basic lab research, right? So I'm kind of ignorant about, like, oh, why don't, you know, cures for this and that. And if you look back through medical history, there's tons of cures for many, many things, right? And there's also, like, just vaccinations alone have uplifted humanity from many, many diseases. And many things have become cured. Sometimes it takes time. Science is messy and it takes time. But like, just think about the HIV epidemic to where it is now. You can have a normal life with HIV, assuming you have health insurance in the United States, which is another ridiculous thing to, you know, think about. But symptom management is important. And then the whole other component of answering this question is preventative medicine. So many of the diseases that people suffer with are many of them are preventative, right? Or it can be managed. I mean, you just take diabetes or high blood pressure for one, right? So people can get diabetes and high blood pressure. But sometimes they just don't have good preventative care for whatever reason, right? Their segmentation, go to a doctor, they don't have good access to healthcare, whatever the reason is. And then they have a hemorrhagic stroke because they're hypertensive and they've been walking around for high blood pressure for 20 years. Right. And so part of it is mitigating, part of the symptom management is mitigating the consequences of poor preventative care. So that's another huge, huge component of this, of why we treat symptoms and why medicine is kind of a last resort for a lot of people. Many people have to use the emergency department as primary care because they don't have access to healthcare. And so people will go a long time without having any healthcare, then the disaster happens. And now we are in, crisis mode. We're trying to mitigate that. So it's a very big, complicated answer. I could do a whole hour of it. But honestly, I'm not even that well informed to even talk about it, because I don't understand the whole breadth of medical history. And there are many cures that have happened. So it's all of the above. All of the things are happening. All right, let's talk about some books. Let me know if you liked this, that just answering questions. Because sometimes I don't do podcasts because I'm like, I don't really have a topic to talk about, but maybe you don't care that I have a topic to talk about. So let me know if you liked this just kind of random grab bag of questions. And then, of course, you can always email me with questions. And I prioritize answering questions from people that email me at TikTok. So icudoctorecmo@gmail.com is my email address. Okay, I want to talk about this book, The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love by Bell Hooks. I've known about Bell Hooks for a while, and I've never read her. And I got to say, this is one of the most amazing books I've ever read. It was written in 2003, and it's short. It's a brief book. It's about 200 pages. And this book is about compassionate feminism for men, basically. Bell Hooks argues that you can critique patriarchy without hating men, which shouldn't be a revelation for people. Systems of oppression, which is what patriarchy is, it's a system of oppression, cannot be dismantled. Dismantling is the wrong word. You can't have an improvement. You can't move from a system of oppression, in my opinion, while you are while you're trying to destroy people that make up the system, if that's making any sense. What I mean is, you can't change patriarchy by trying to destroy men, which is like the militant wing of feminism. And I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm an expert on feminism movement, because I'm definitely not. But from a lot of my readings, one of the really highly influential books is The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which I've talked about in this. You cannot change a system by using the same tools of an oppressor, meaning you cannot attack. I guess what I'm trying to say is, this book is a critique that you can critique patriarchy while including men with it and not hating men. So she says the militant feminism movement chooses to hate men and does not recognize that women seek and hunger the love of husbands and fathers. And it is the toxic barriers of patriarchy that prevent men from being emotionally available. But don't get me wrong. This book is not about criticizing feminism. It's about broadening its scope to include men. In patriarchy, men have to prove their worth through what they do by pretty much only exercising two emotions, fear and danger. Right? Men just really quickly, swiftly during adolescence, boys are alienated from their own emotions. And they become disenchanted, disenfranchised from themselves and their families. And each men and boys become these rogue, miserable agents of anger and isolation. Obviously, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this is what gender socialization does to young boys. It tells them that their emotions that they're feeling, the spectrum of emotions that they have, is wrong, that they shouldn't have the spectrum, and that they should only exercise a couple emotions: anger, domination, and fear. And patriarchy promises happiness to men, right? The unspoken promise to men that's taught to them is that they'll find happiness by domination, whether that's domination of women or domination of the workplace or domination of whatever it is, that's where men will find happiness. But then when boys are loosed on the world, when they grow and they become young men and they're loosed upon the world, polite society pretends that these things were not promised to men, right? That there's other rules. Oh, you must follow etiquette and things like this. And then men are left with a feeling of abandonment, and they're angry. They're angry about what was implicitly promised to them as boys is now denied to them. So the backlash is violence, sociopathy, and psychopathy. Patriarchy has everyone believe that sex is something that men must have, or they go crazy like wild animals, and it justifies their dominating behavior. And that is essentially what rape culture is. Men must have it. Oh, they got to do it. No, they don't. What has happened is men have been decoupled from intimacy and sex. They've been decoupled from intimacy, and then sex for them has been corrupted into this bizarre act of dominance and isolation. I don't think it's too big of a stretch to say that what most men perceive as sex is enormously pathologic. Here's the truth that bell hooks shows us about patriarchy. Most men are actually not in control of anything, right? There's many men. It's like half the population. Most men don't have the control and power that they maybe implicitly were taught that they would have. They're not in power. Now, people in power are mostly men, right? I'm saying a different thing. But most men are actually not in power. Now, I can be challenged on that. And I'm quoting bell hooks. That's not me saying this, but I agree with her. But that's certainly debatable. But most men are not in power. And because of that, they can be feeling depressed and frustrated and lonely and angry because of the promise of patriarchal power to them is a lie. And that's what this book is about. Men should read this book. I mean, women should read this book, but I don't know if women will learn anything new because they live it. But men should read this book. I'm reading a book right now, which I'll give more of a formal review later, but it's by David Graeber, who, I love him. It's called The Utopia of Rules. And I just wanted to talk about this concept that is new to me, and it's called interpretive labor. And what he talks about is in systems of oppression, like patriarchy or white supremacy, there's those that are oppressed, like women or like black people, they bear more of the interpretive labor. What he means by that is women, on average, right? I'm generalizing here. They're better at interpreting emotional behavior and physical behavior, how people are behaving, and trying to interpret, like, this person's behaving this way. What does that mean? What's going on in their head, right? So that's interpretive behavior. That's what people that are oppressed must do to understand the power dynamics. People that are in power don't have to do interpretive behavior because they use violence or the threat of violence or domination, which does not require emotional understanding. And so when you live in a default patriarchal society, which we do, our society is still deeply, deeply patriarchal, in my opinion, and that's really irrefutable. Men, on average, don't have to exercise interpretive labor. They don't need to understand emotional relationships. And I think this has a lot to do with why a lot of men behave the way that they behave. They don't understand that women, I don't understand women. Or, women have this magical intuition. No, they don't have magical intuition. They just bear the burden of interpretive labor to try to understand the power dynamics that are going on to survive violence and domination. It's just an amazing concept. And it applies to a lot of oppressive systems, this interpretive labor from this book by Dave Gerber, which I'll talk about later. It's an amazing book. I'm reading it right now. But this original book, The Will to Change by Bell Hooks, amazing book. I highly recommend you read it. Highly, highly recommend it. All right, I'm going to talk about another nonfiction book. I just enjoyed I've read so many books since I last did this podcast that I have so many I want to get to. So I'm just going to talk a little bit more. This book, and this is a well-known book. It's called Factfulness by Hans Rosling. You've probably have heard of it. You may have heard of it. It was published, 2018, and it's 340 pages. The author has since passed, and he's a really nice guy. Obviously, he's a very good. He was a physician in Sweden, and I'm going to be a little critical of this book, but I do want to say that, I do think the author is a good guy. He's quirky and he's weird and he swallows swords for some reason, but he absolutely seems to be like a very good person. So I want to say that up front before I now will proceed to criticize this book. So basically, this book should have been a spreadsheet of data. And you could have just read a spreadsheet of statistics. This book is the same thing to me. So it succeeds on some very minor points, but it fails on more important and nuanced points. Here's what I mean. This book has the depth of a TED Talk, and it suffers from the hubris of the writer thinking he's got like a bag of obscure and magic statistics that show how the world really operates. And what the book is about is that global statistics are actually really good. Right, global poverty and infant mortality and education and vaccination rate, all these things trend in a really good direction, and which is true. And his point is like people miss this fact and they perseverate on all the bad things of the world, blah, blah, blah. But here's the problem with the narrative of this book, which does have a narrative. It's not just like, hey, here's the facts. It has a narrative. He's crafting a narrative. He cherry picks a bunch of statistics and then he sprinkles them around a fundamentally immoral global system and then claims that we're all just so woefully misled about the current state of the world that it's so much better than we think it is. He constantly repeats over and over again how people say the world is getting worse without qualifying that. And then he throws in some good global trends at the reader and then step back and says, hey, we've all been deceived by all the doomsday, you know, the news. He makes a lot of terribly employed false equivalencies throughout the book. Like he equates high vaccine rates to good access to healthcare or equates low income to impoverishment. These are not the same things, but there's a lot of good in the book. I love how he talked about how terrible people are at calculating risk, which we are. Terrorism is essentially a non-statistical threat where alcohol is one of the biggest mortal dangers to you and your loved ones. But news headlines don't care about alcohol. They care about terrorism. This is a profound and very important point of the book. And I think he hit the nail right on the head. But his arguments are all a matter of framing. It's easy to appeal to optimism by pointing out how peaceful the world is when you just follow trend lines, right? This doesn't change the fact that there remains global war and famine and poverty at unacceptable rates. Now, I do think Rosalind does he does point out that just because some global trends are heading in a good direction, that doesn't mean we ignore the sad state of conditions that still exists. And he should be applauded for that. He does make that point. But ultimately, I think this book is giving a prescription for a minor problem, which is that many people give undue weight to news headlines. I just wish that he really got into the nitty-gritty of the reality of the world and the globalized economic system that is at play that perpetuates ongoing poverty while enriching very few people. This book endorses Western society exceptionalism without realizing it's doing it. A more honest discussion would involve the ludicrously low poverty line set by the first place by the World Bank that makes the trends look good to begin with. A deeper discussion would involve the role of the United States, you know, hegemonic control, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the role of the CIA, and the destabilizing role of the CIA, the anti-communism panic that destabilized the world, multinational corporate interests abroad. This book, that gives a more fleshed out appearance of what's going on in the world when you talk about those things, but it doesn't mention any of these things. This book is an unwitting endorsement of Western globalization and provides a very narrow view. And I think people use this book to prop it up and be like, hey, everybody's wrong. The world's going great. And like, no, this is a very narrow view. I think the aims of the book are to help the reader think critically about the world based on statistical facts. That is a great message, but I think Rosling gives very weak tools to the reader. He delves into not getting distracted by averages, which is a good advice, but doesn't go any deeper into how easily stats can be massaged. I found the statistical analysis of the book really laughably simplistic. Overall, I like the book, But there are way, way better books out there with much more robust statistical analysis and criticism about human bias, many of which I've mentioned here. Calling Bullshit is an amazing book. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, Thinking Fast and Slow, Think Again. Other books to read rather than this one are The Divide by Jason Hickel or Border and Rule by Harsha Walia. Anyway, those books give a much better idea of what's going on in the world than this book. Okay, I'm going to wrap up today talking about one more book, and it's a book I wrote. It's my sixth book that I publish. It's fiction. It's coming out November 4th, 2023, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it. It's called Saint Elspeth. My pen name is Wick Welker, W-I-C-K-W-E-L-K-E-R, Wick Welker. And I want to tell you a little bit about it because I want to give it away to you. An advanced review copy. If you're interested, you can email me at icudrecmo@gmail.com. And for, I don't know, a limited time, I don't know, a month or something, I'll send it out to my listeners of my podcast. I don't really care about making money off my books. I just like to get into readers' hands. I love the joy of writing fiction and putting it in people's hands is why I write. So let me just tell you a little bit about this book. I got the idea to write this book when I was jogging in San Francisco one day, and the plot elements just fell into my head, and it took me, I don't know, about a year and a half to write, amongst other projects. So let me just set it up for you. So imagine a bunch of alien pods show up in this. So it's sci-fi and it's post-apocalyptic. So imagine today a bunch of alien pods showed up in the sky, and they're just floating in the sky. The world would go nuts, right? And then these alien pods, they don't do anything. But they descend and they land in like every country in the world. And they just sit there. They don't do anything. They just sit there. And they sit there for weeks and then months. And the world completely shuts down. And what happens is one country is so threatened by these alien invaders, even though they haven't done anything, that they blow them up in their borders. And then they say to the country next to them, if you don't blow yours up, we're going to do it for you. And then that causes conflict. That causes nuclear fallout. And the world is basically destroyed because of humanity's overreaction to the aliens showing up. That's the backstory of my book, of Saint Elspeth. And then the book takes place 20 years later, where California is basically, and the western part of the United States is the only part of the country that has survived nuclear fallout. And the main character is Elspeth Darrow is her name. And she's like in her 50s or her late 50s. She was alive before the fall. She survived a bunker and then recolonized San Francisco, which was not harmed from the nuclear war. And she now runs a hospital of a colony in San Francisco of about 15,000 people. She's the only doctor. She was a pathologist before this all happened, but now she has to do everything. So she's exhausted. She also lost her husband and she had a stillborn birth while this was all happening. So she's suffered personal tragedy and she's exhausted. And she kind of hates her life a little bit. So that's the main character. She needs to go on a salvaging expedition to restock supplies in her hospital because patients are dying. There's a lot of tension with the mayor. And as she's out exploring with some young men, they find a dead alien body. And nobody has seen these aliens in 20 years. And it's just floating there in the bay. And there you have it. That's all I'm giving you. That's all I'm getting. You got to read the rest. So I'm excited about it. I think it's a good book. I think it's the best thing I've written. It's my sixth novel. So email me. If you're a listener of this podcast, just email me at, I keep forgetting my email. ICUDrEcmo, ECMO, @gmail.com. And I will send you an ebook. I'll send you an EPUB. You can load it up in your Kindle. It's super easy. I just email it to you, pop it open, read it. And then if you read it, leave a review. An honest review if you like it, or don't, whatever. If you want it, I'll send it to you. So just let me know. That's it. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.